Brembo Red, High Performance Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Dan Sandberg back in the Brembo Red studio. It really is red in here. I wish you guys could see this. You know, maybe we should start broadcasting this podcast live. It seems to be the trend right now. Give us something else to do while we're either quarantining or staring at the walls at home here. I guess I never realized how red they really were. Anyway, we'll have to check with the Brembo team on that. But in the meantime, I have a pretty slick podcast for you this month. We have one of the big up-and-coming hot drivers in the NASCAR Cup Series, Alex Bowman. And he'll talk to us in just a few minutes about the 2020 season and give us really an inside look at NASCAR and his career. He's also a dog whisperer, so another four-legged lover in the race car world. But first, I have one of my favorite people in the automotive world here on Brembo Red, Ralf Gilles, head of design for FCA. That's Fiat Chrysler, for those of you who aren't into initials. And soon to be Stellantis, once FCA and PSA get together. There's too many initials there, aren't there?
I mean, yeah, that's why we came up with the name.
You know, Ralf, you were born in New York City, but I refuse to believe he's really not a Detroit car guy, because somewhere along the lines, he really got into cars, and we're going to talk about that. But thanks for being with us on Brembo Red.
It's a pleasure. Yeah, I've been in Detroit since 1988, so it's been a bit. You know?
And you're really a lover of cars. I mean, I see you when you're not working. I see you at car events, charity events, sometimes on the track. I know you've done some car rallies, and I'm looking at you right now in your pole barn, you call it. I think other people would call it heaven. Lots of nice cars behind you, and you judge at concours events. Okay, so who, what, when did they put the gasoline in your blood? Where did this start?
You know, that's a very good question. I found out early on in life that car people are the coolest people. They really are, because I found a happy place there. You know, like-mindedness, you know, took care of any racist stuff. There was never any animosity in that group, because anytime I hung out with the car people, I felt totally at home, and all we talked about was cars and how fast they were, and, you know, told tall tales, all that stuff. So I would say even as early as 7, 8 years old, because I lived in Montreal, and the circus called Formula One would come to town every summer. And with that came all of the cool cars. So all the people from northern New York, from Toronto, they all kind of descended on Montreal, and this downtown was like a car show. Not to mention the sounds of the F1 cars testing in the background. It was just heaven. So that it's hard not to get infected when you're surrounded by that.
And your first, what you would call collector car, was a what?
Oh, man, I wouldn't say it was a collector car. The first car I cared about was a Volkswagen Scirocco S. It was from one of my favorite designers to this day, Jujaro. And I just love the lines of the car. I remember seeing it back in the 70s when I was a kid and going, ooh, that's a cool car. It looks accessible. Of course, I love, like any kid, I loved all the Lamborghinis, and I used to watch Magnum PI only because of the Ferrari, and Dukes of Hazzard only because of the Charger, and used to watch all this. Come to think of it, what happened to all the car-themed TV shows?
Well, you know, as a designer, like, you talk about car lines, and I'm not going to ask you this because I never get to ask a true designer. When you look at a car, what's the first thing you see in a car?
I look at the personality of the car. I immediately typically look at the front end, the front view. Does it speak to me? Does it look like almost humanistic? Does it have a way of staring back at you? Does the car have an attitude or not? And most good cars that you remember have a certain very memorable face, just like a person does, right? So I think that's one thing. And next is the stance. And then I get into the performance numbers. But that doesn't matter to me so much as that first impression.
So let's talk about EVs, which seems to come up in the conversation when you talk cars these days. And from a design perspective, is there a certain design cue that you're seeing on EVs that are coming out right now that you say, oh, I can't believe they do that? That is, why do they do that?
Yeah, I would say the trend of trying too hard. You know, when you see EVs that are made from regular vehicles where they adapt the powertrains, they're not born as EVs, they're converted. They do a lot of stuff to try to hide the fact that they used to be a gas car. You know, they put a lot of schmaltz on it and, you know, details. And I really admire the vehicles that are born as EVs. They have a unique Porsche. I'll give credit to Porsche with the Taycan. And even our friend, you know, Mr. Elon with his Teslas, have a certain aesthetic that's unique to them based on the powertrain not ever being in the front end, you know. So I think when they're gussied up is when I don't like them. And then when they're committed and benefit from their new portions is when I do like them.
So I guess my next question is kind of along that line. So you have certain functional design things that go on in a car. For example, a grill, all right? Pretty common.
Correct.
Well, you don't need it in an EV. do you take it out or do you leave it in or do you play games with it or do you still make it look like an internal combustion engine car? What do you do with those things that you don't really need anymore?
So that's funny you mentioned that because I used to tease our friends at Tesla about that because they had a grill that was just a glossy black thing that looked like a grill but wasn't really a grill. It was just there to give, I guess, comfort to the owners that are transitioning. But I think as a segment matures, less and less of that is apparent because you're right. The cooling is very different. You can cool from the bottom or the back of the car, or the side of the car, because you're just cooling the gel pack or the battery sits in. So that part is very, very different. And I think eventually the aesthetic, because if you think about the radiator, we've been designing around the grill since the teens. I mean, the industry has. But as people get more and more used to smoothie front ends, I would say, that don't need the grill, because we really don't have to worry about it anymore. As more and more cars look that way, if you think about mid-engine supercars, they've not really had front ends. And the aerodynamic requirements of an EV do require the front end to get quite sneaky and low, which means there's really much room for the grill anyway. So I think that look of efficiency and electrification will become synonymous with a grillless front end.
We've talked about horsepower, and we continue to talk about horsepower wars on this podcast. And if you aren't personally responsible for the start of that war, then I think you definitely had to be an accomplice anyway. So you led the design, if I recall, of the Dodge Charger and Magnum. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, led to the Hellcat, which has, by the way, 800 horsepower. There is rumors also that the new Dodge Ram TRX truck, right, is going to have over 700 horsepower. Is that true?
Yeah.
And rumor has it that I have 760 horsepower of Mustang in my garage. It's just a rumor, though. but my first question to you, will we see a production car with over 1,000 horsepower from FCA or one of its competitors before 2025?
I would think so, but it may not be in the way that you think. It might be a combination of electrification and gas, which is something that you see. I believe, the trends start in the supercar world, which they already have. You see them combining electrification and gas. I'm not going to commit exactly which brand, but something along those lines, because we can. I mean, the technology's there. It's relatively, I would say, elegant to do now, especially if you can combine electrification and combustion together. And that's kind of what's happening anyway. If you think about the industry, we have hybrids and plug-in hybrids as well. So the transition, including all of the above in a way, so does performance. So eventually they'll probably be pure electrics, but in the meantime we're getting from both worlds.
Why do you need all that horsepower in a truck per se?
I don't know. That's a very good question. And the difference between that power, in the 60s it was scary because it wasn't a tire technology. It wasn't stability control systems. Today, I believe that the power is more accessible. And most people, they're smart enough not to use it on public roads. There's a lot of tracks. What used to be, I guess, the country club is now becoming the track club. There's tons of these kind of country club style tracks showing up where you can go exercise your car safely. Drag racing has kind of come back. People rent out, parts of Nevada freeways or big ex-military landing to go play with their cars. Definitely a market for that power because people love the feeling. It's like strapping on Iron Man suit, right? You feel superhuman. As long as I'm completely against street racing. I think it's really a silly thing to even think about, but there's plenty of ways where you can go have fun with your car. Yeah.
Is this the last big war of horsepower? I mean, is this the last gasp of the internal combustion engine before all the EVs take over? Or do you think we still have several years left of internal combustion engines?
I grew up in the 70s, I'm sure, as you did too. And I remember being nervous about that. Is it over? Is the muscle car gone? And look what's happened since, right? So, ingenuity has found a way. Things are different. Pressures are different. Climate change is definitely something we all think about and are concerned about. I would say the last bastion, but I think it's going to become more and more niche over time where the gas engine cars, I don't think they're going to be banned anytime soon, but you're going to see less and less of it because manufacturers are turning their attention to electrification, as we are too. We're investing a lot in that. We're not really developing gas as much. We're turning most of our engineers into electrification engineers. It's starting to converge. The cost of batteries are getting better. There's a little more, you know, I would say economies of scale starting to show up in the EV world. So it's getting affordable. Today, nobody makes money on electric cars. Not even the best of them do. But eventually, I think with all of us working on it, it'll get there. And once you taste a well-engineered electric car, it's hard to deny it isn't thrilling. You know, it's just the range. And once the range issue gets solved, I think it's really an elegant thing.
Ralph, I got to take a quick break. But when we get back, I want to talk about designing the inside of the vehicle rather than the outside. So stay with us. You're listening to Brembo Red. We'll be back after this.
I may never have met you. We don't go way back. Maybe we wouldn't even be friends if we did. But when you wear a mask, you have my respect. Because your mask doesn't protect you. It protects me. I wear my mask to protect you. Mask up, America.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Back in the studio with Ralph Gilles, head designer for Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, now known as Stellantis. Let me ask you about EVs inside, all right? Every single EV I see inside, and I know you have some Michigan State in you, so when I say that they're very Spartan, you probably think, well, what's wrong with that? But they're so simple inside, almost, they call it elegant. I call it like, where's the rest of the other stuff that's supposed to go inside?
And there's two reasons for that. One is because I'm not kidding. There's so much money spent on the powertrain. The batteries are really expensive, and a battery pack can be up to $20,000 for a car, which is more than the price of an entire normal car, right? So that's consuming a lot of money. So there's not much money left. And secondly, is the consumption of electricity. So any feature you put in the interior, especially extra screens or lighting, anything like that, burns up voltage and amperage, right? So some of that reason, and Tesla will tell you that's why there's only one big screen in the car, because they only want to power one display versus multiple displays. So that's part of the reason. And thirdly, I think it's more this kind of theme of the jour, I guess, modern and almost, I would say, spaceship-y. But I think with time, again, you're going to see a lot more variety.
All right, let's come back to current reality. And we've been hearing a lot about these big SUVs from the past, right? I'll talk about Bronco, which we've had some of the guys on the podcast about that. But you got a big name of your own that you're going to bring to market, the Wagoneer. And all of us remember that big honking SUV in the past. What can you tell us about the new Wagoneer that's coming out? It's not going to be the boxy wood monster from what I've seen in the pictures I've seen, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because we've had the Wagoneer back in our studios. And yeah, you think in your mind is a big vehicle, but it's about the size of a Durango. It wasn't all that big. But in your mind, and the reason you think of it big is it's the only one back then. There wasn't really much to choose from the 1960s. It was the only premium SUV out there. And it was very luxurious. Lots of time first features that were on that car that weren't even on luxury cars at the time. So fast forward to today, and very soon, early next year, we're going to launch officially the production version of the Wagoneer. We look at it. We've looked at it a few times. I've actually designed five other Wagoneers that never made it. And this time we're like, you know what? We've studied the segment. We realize this particular customer that loves this type of vehicle, they really do use it as it's intended. A lot of them carpool with two families worth of people, or they have big, big families, or they live in the country. They have long distances to travel. They take a lot of gear with them. And it's been a very stable segment, and we haven't played in that segment. We stopped kind of at Durango size. No, our dealers have been asking for this. I mean, every time I talk to dealers, like, when are you going to have a full-size UV to compete with the Suburbans and the Escalades and Navigators? So it's a ready-made market for us. I mean, we really need this vehicle in our portfolio.
Obviously, you said you got dealers who are asking for it. I'm sure you're talking to consumers who are asking for it also. When I look at some of the big auctions that you can watch on TV, you see these 70 and 80 big SUV vehicles, the old stuff, going for some astronomical prices. Do you guys in the car business look at that at all, too, and say there's this yearning for this?
Absolutely. Our whole team went down to Wagon Master down in, I think they're in Arizona, I think, or Colorado. But they restore old Wagoneers, and they have literally a waiting list of people. But it shows you that there's this affection for the name, and there's a respect for it. We actually showed them the new design, and they love it. They think, thank you. This is cool. This is going to work for us, because it gets the name back in people's lexicon, and there's going to be all these articles comparing, you know, the new one to the old one. So it'll be good for them. But I'm actually hats off to them for keeping the name out there and keeping it alive for us.
Well, Ralph, I appreciate you spending some of your downtime and barn time, if you will. Those cars look really nice back there, too.
Thank you.
Did you pick up any new hobbies or anything, or go back to old hobbies to keep yourself busy during the pandemic?
I started getting fit again, working out a little bit, and I'm all caught up in most of my car projects, little maintenance stuff, because I have, you know, quite a few cars. I've been, you know, each one of them at any given time needs an oil change or something, so I'm caught up there. But there's the infamous honey-do list that my wife, because I'm home, I'm basically her handyman, you know.
That's the way it works. Ralph Giles, head of design for FCA, now known as Stellantis. Thanks for the conversation, Ralph. And maybe we can get together and drive some cars or something soon. I hope so.
Be great. Take care. See you then.
Alex Bowman, driver of the number 48 Ally Chevrolet car from the Hendrick Motorsports NASCAR Cup team, will join us right after this quick break. Back in 30 seconds.
You're listening to Brembo Red.
Brembo has been stopping champions on the track as well as drivers like you and me on the street for over 50 years. And you can get a complete set of Brembo premium brake replacement rotors and pads at buybrembo.com. Buybrembo.com will help you identify the exact pads and rotors you need and help you achieve that 60-0 braking performance you deserve and expect from Brembo. Brembo, the choice of champions and consumers for over 50 years.
Welcome back to Brembo Red, and when we talk about a high-performance podcast, that means high-performance guests. We're going to head on over to the NASCAR circuit, and Alex Bowman is with us in the Brembo Red studio. Alex, thank you very much for joining us on Brembo Red.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
How you been doing during the quarantine? What new hobbies have you developed during the quarantine?
Yeah, it hasn't been so much new hobbies. It's just been more projects with the same hobbies. So I'm a big car guy. I have a shop in Mooresville. And quarantine started a couple big projects for us. We built a wing sprint car, built a drift car, kind of just bounced around and would get one started and get to a point where I was waiting on stuff. And I'm like, oh, we could do something else too. So started all kinds of really cool projects and built some really, really neat stuff.
You really are a car guy, right? From way back.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of it really comes from growing up racing. My dad was always really busy and I always drove my own stuff. So somebody had to work on it and it wasn't going to be my dad. So it had to be me. And just having to work on and take care of my own stuff really made me appreciate the mechanical side of things. And my dad owns a small paint shop in Arizona. So I would go there and work during the day and do a lot of prep work. But yeah, I mean, I fell in love with cars and it's really interesting. My dad and I are polar opposites. I mean, he's a big car guy, but he loves things like completely stock and not changed at all, just exactly how they're supposed to be. And I have to change everything. So I can't leave anything alone from, you know, my daily driver that makes 800 horsepower to I have a C6 Corvette ZR1 that makes a little over 1100 horsepower to the rear tires. So can't leave anything alone. I work on it all myself and really enjoy it.
You started racing at age 7. Is that a prerequisite now to success in racing in the modern era? Do you have to start before you're able to speak?
You would think so, but then you get to a point where you look at guys like William Byron, who I don't think he started till he was like 14 years old, and he was in Cup by the time he was like 19. So it's pretty wild how kind of the iRacing thing has changed it and how quickly some of the kids have come up. But I think I was kind of in the time period where that wasn't really around. And, you know, you had to start pretty young just to gain experience.
What's in your DNA that makes you a great racer? You know, you're a quiet guy from what I hear, but are you super competitive underneath?
Yeah, I'm really competitive. You know, I think I'm pretty quiet because I care more about how we run than I probably should. Like if we have a bad weekend, I'm going to be pretty upset until the next weekend and we have a chance to make it right and do better. So, you know, I definitely let that get to me a little more than I wish I did, but definitely super competitive. I have really high expectations of myself. So when I make a mistake myself, I beat myself up pretty good, but just really want to run well and win races. And that's really all that matters to me.
You know, Alex, when I look at your career progression, you've had some great opportunities, or like we like to say at Brembo, some great breaks. But, you know, I look at Dale Earnhardt Jr., all right? You took his seat when he stepped away. And now, Jimmy Johnson, the 48 car, you're going to step into that car. First of all, the most popular driver out there, and then the winningest driver out there, you're going to sit in his car. How do you handle that kind of pressure?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. You know, you would think they would be really similar situations between taking over the 88 and then taking over the 48, and they've really been very different so far. You know, taking over the 88, I think there was a lot of pressure to try to be like Dale, and I can't be Dale. Like, that's not me. That's not who I am. It's not who I want to be. I just want to be myself. And going to the 48 so far has been a lot of being able to be myself and being able to be me. And it's been really cool to work with allies so far. And I think most of the pressure really comes from myself. Like, I want to run well for me. I mean, yeah, I want to run well for Ally and Hendrick Motorsports and Chevrolet and everybody that puts so much effort into the cars, but I want to run well for me and I want to take trophies home for me. So I probably put more pressure on myself than any outside source really can. But yeah, any top level of motorsports is pressure filled. You look at guys that are just saying, oh no, this is just so much fun, blah, blah, blah. They're lying to you.
So let me ask you this. So you had a pretty good year, 2020, number 6 in points in NASCAR. What's on your tick list here for you to get from 6 to 1? What are you thinking about?
I think the biggest thing was we needed to run how we ran in the playoffs all year long. We were really good at the beginning of the year. We really struggled through the summer. And then right before the playoffs, we turned it on. And I think we had like the second best average finish through the playoffs and second most points accumulated through the playoffs. So if we could run like that all year, we would have so many more playoff points to start with that making that round of four becomes so much easier. And then we can go to Phoenix and try to win.
So it's creating that playoff mindset throughout the entire season, basically.
Yeah, and I don't think, like, we didn't change anything for the playoffs. We didn't start bringing better race cars or change what we were doing or try harder. You know, you're 100% each and every week. Something just clicked at Dover a couple weeks before the playoffs and carried all the way through. And my team was really able to, like, buckle down and work really hard through it. And everybody did a really good job, like, sticking together. So I think that was a big positive. And obviously, them sticking together ended up turning the season around and having a really great playoff run. But we've just got to keep it switched on all year.
You know, everybody focuses on the driver, but this really is a team sport, isn't it? Everybody's got to participate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have 600 employees at Hendrick Motorsports that each and every one of them have an incredibly important job and so many smart people there. It's so cool to walk in there and get to lean on the people that work there. But yeah, I mean, we've definitely got a great team behind us, and without each and every one of them, we couldn't do it.
So you and I have something in common. You are a dog whisperer, and so am I. I have Reese, who is our mascot. She's been on the Brembo Red podcast, not intentionally, but she shows up and whines every so often. How did you get into the dog thing, and tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that area?
Yeah, so, well, I had dogs growing up, but that's different. Your parents take care of them. Like, it's different, right? When I was driving my first year in the Xfinity Series, I ended up at the pound some on a random day and brought home Roscoe. Roscoe is like a beagle hound mix. So you can guess how stubborn and loud and whiny he is. So 19-year-old me had my hands full with him. He was tough for sure. And he still is tough. He's a very interesting dog and just really became a dog person from there on out. And now I have Finn as well, who's a lab, and I love him. My favorite part about having dogs is they don't care how you ran. So you get home from the weekend and walk in the door, and they're happy to see you whether you won or you finished 40th. So really enjoy that. But they're a huge part of my life for sure.
And you've been able to integrate your love for dogs into your work life and your celebrity. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think really been the coolest part about working with Ally is I worked with a lot of partners that are like, we're going to do this and you're going to do this. And like, this is how we're going to do this. And Ally is like, hey, what do you want to do? Like, here's some ideas, but do you want to do anything? And first thing I was like, well, if we're going to do charity stuff, let's work with dogs. So they donated $75,000 to the Humane Society of Charlotte, which was really cool. And we went down and spent a day down there and filmed some stuff and hung out with some dogs, which was probably the most fun appearance that I've ever had to do. So that was really neat. You know, I didn't realize, you look at all the different humane societies, and the one in Charlotte is pretty far behind. So they have a tiny little building that's falling apart, and they're working really hard to build a new building. It's going to be this massive state-of-the-art place. So they've got land already, and they're working on that. But it was cool to be a small part of that and, you know, actually, like, do something that's real to you for your job. It was pretty neat.
Good for you. Alex Bowman, NASCAR supercar driver, I should say. And we appreciate you spending time. We appreciate you driving Brembo brakes when you're out there and winning on them. And we wish you the best of luck. And hopefully you'll come back and join us after you grab that championship. What do you think?
Yeah, sounds good to me. Thanks for having me.
And thanks again to Ralph Gilles from Stellantis. That's formerly Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, FCA. It was great having both Ralph and Alex here on Brembo Red. And of course, thanks to all you guys for downloading and listening to Brembo Red. Don't hesitate to drop us a note at podcast@us.brembo.com. We'd love to hear from you. This is Dan Sandberg from Brembo North America. Please stay safe and healthy. Wear your mask, get your vaccine so we can get back to the track, road, restaurants, and our friends. We'll see you soon here on Brembo Red. Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to podcast@us.brembo.com. Brembo Red is produced and copyrighted by Brembo North America.